From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump today threatened to strongly regulate or close down social media companies, claiming they silence conservative voices, one day after Twitter took the extraordinary step of flagging two of Trump's tweets as false. Trump claimed in those tweets, without evidence, that mail-in ballots would lead to a rigged election.
But Twitter has refused to take down any of the president's tweets, even as he continues to promote another baseless conspiracy theory about former Republican lawmaker, now MSNBC host Joe Scarborough, the president insinuating he is a murderer. Again, it is baseless. Lots to talk about with Brian Stelter, chief media correspondent for CNN. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thank you so much.
Yeah, and start with the tragic death of 28-year-old Lori Klassoutis, a congressional aide to Scarborough in 2001. A medical examiner at the time determined that she collapsed and died of a head injury because of a previously undiagnosed heart condition. Scarborough was not even in the state at the time, but President Trump essentially is accusing him of murder today, tweeting, "Psycho Joe Scarborough is rattled by all the things that are coming out on the internet about opening a cold case." Now, Twitter has said it was deeply sorry for the pain those statements caused, but her widower, Timothy Klassoutis, wrote a letter to Twitter's CEO asking him to take down the horrifying lies, saying Trump has taken the memory of my dead wife, perverted it for perceived political gain. How is Twitter defending leaving them up?
Twitter's not doing a good job of defending this, but they are saying they are following their policies, especially their policies involving world leaders. Twitter has a rule that says that posts or comments that would otherwise violate rules but are posted by world leaders are going to stay up on the platform but might be annotated or fact-checked in some way. The argument basically is that whatever a world leader says is newsworthy, even if it's abusive or offensive or completely false, and thus it needs to stay up and not be deleted. A lot of people look at this policy and say, Twitter's just afraid of Trump and afraid of other world leaders, afraid of being punished or regulated or something like that. And so that's why they're making these exceptions. And I think, frankly, nobody comes away happy about this. There's no clean, great solution to these problems because the fundamental problem is a war on truth that's being led by the American president, involving, in this case, an innocent family that's being traumatized.
Well, and this is why some might ask, but Twitter has guidelines about targeted harassment. But as you say,
right,
you know, this would not apply because it's trumped, if you will, by the fact that Trump is a world leader. take on the claims about the presidential election and mail-in ballots. Now, Twitter has long been under pressure to stop the spread of misinformation. They've stepped up labeling of disputed information about the coronavirus lately, but you know, then we have these claims about election fraud. Again, there is little evidence of mail-in ballot fraud. So now Twitter is flagging those tweets from the president. Why are those being flagged?
Yeah, and why are those being flagged and not these heinous claims against Joe Scarborough? How is it that a president can accuse a private citizen of murder and it just stays up on the internet for all to see? It's a crazy thing. But I think, you know, Twitter finds that it's in this awful situation where it's being asked to police and fact check the president every day. And the company is very resistant to being in that position. I think they've taken action on the mail-in ballot lies because they say they have specific rules about election integrity. And if you try to lie about election, the procedures of an election, then Twitter says it'll take action. It also, as you mentioned, has taken really strong action involving the coronavirus. If you are on the platform spreading lies about vaccines, your posts are probably going to be removed or flagged by Twitter. I think the company believes it's a lot safer to deal with health questions than political questions. And as soon as anything seems political, their feet get very cold.
Well, but in the meantime, the president is saying that this is political. He tweeted out today, Twitter is now interfering in the 2020 presidential election by flagging his tweets. They're saying my statement on mail-in ballots, which will lead to massive corruption and fraud. Again, there is no evidence to that. They're saying, he says, my statement is incorrect based on fact-checking by fake news, CNN, and the Amazon Washington Post owned by Jeff Bezos. So, in other words, he's saying Twitter has now shown, he says in another tweet, everything we've been saying about them is correct. Big action to follow. He's saying they're the ones who are violating some sort of creed. Do you think he will take action against social media companies?
I do not, but I do think he'll make a lot of noise. This is the same way he treats news outlets he doesn't like, by making lots of noise against them and about them. He has threatened to sue newspapers, for example, and then doesn't follow through. I think it'll be similar with Twitter and Facebook and other social media platforms, because he wants this fight heading into 2020. He wants his base to believe that big technology companies are aligned against them. In some ways, this is like a convenient target, the same way the national news media is a convenient target. But ultimately, this is about the president saying, you should only believe me and the people that I approve. He wants only approved sources of information, whether that's attacking CNN or attacking Twitter. It's all about the same thing.
Oh, but just in the few seconds we have, Brian Stelter, is this like Twitter's Pandora's box? Have they lost control?
I think they have, because once they've fact-checked one thing from the president, they're going to be under pressure to fact-check hundreds of other things, and from other leaders of other countries as well. I'm not sure how this ends.
No. Brian Stelter, chief media correspondent for CNN. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the coronavirus pandemic has put a major strain on funeral homes and cemeteries in parts of the U.S. In New Jersey, one of the hardest hit states, residents have died at twice the typical rate in March and April alone. While healthcare workers grab many of the headlines, death care workers confront similar threats to their health and psychological well-being. Nick Pugliese from member station WHYY has that story.
Jeff Dodson organizes so many burials now, he sometimes doesn't realize a friend has died until he's preparing their final resting place.
Just people I've known from working here for so long. You know, people that I would see, you know, a couple times a year, or I'd help plant flowers for, or, you know, and then I'm out marking a grave and I'm like, oh my gosh, this was, you know, Mrs. So-and-so.
The foreman at the Glendale Cemetery in Bloomfield in North Jersey says his workload has tripled since the pandemic hit in early March.
Sometimes I go home and I'm just not myself, and my wife has to kind of grab me by the shoulders and say, it's okay, you're home, we're here, and they get me out of it.
Workers like Dodson are on the front lines of the pandemic, even if they toil largely out of sight. As he puts it,
I'm kind of the back end of the frontline workers, you know.
It's a class that also includes funeral directors and religious leaders, and now even police officers and members of the National Guard. All are risking physical and mental exhaustion to care for the deceased and their families.
I think post-traumatic stress will be what a lot of us will be dealing with.
George Kelder leads the New Jersey State Funeral Directors Association.
We're too much into the fray right now to really take a breather.
He says social distancing is anathema to funeral directors, who must now make arrangements over the phone rather than comforting families in person.
This is not what we signed up for. We signed up to be caregivers, and now we've simply become order takers.
Kurt Larson, a funeral director in Bergen County, puts it another way.
I think we choose funeral service because we want to help the living, right? Experience the transition of loss. And that includes saying yes to whatever they would like to have.
But now,
the traditional funeral as we know it doesn't exist, at least within our funeral home right now. We're not doing viewings. We're not doing services. Churches are closed.
It took more than a month for funeral home workers to get the proper protective equipment. In New Jersey, at least two funeral directors have died after contracting the virus. Although the death rate in New Jersey is slowing, there's still a 1 to 2 week backlog at crematories. That leaves the morgues at hospitals and funeral homes overwhelmed as well. In response, the state has set up several refrigerated trailers in Newark to house hundreds of bodies until their final disposition. State Police Superintendent Pat Callahan says it's a challenging job for the troopers and National Guardsmen who work there.
It's not a normal thing to go through, to open up a tractor trailer and see the remains of 82 people, you know, per trailer.
Callahan publicly encourages the workers to look after their mental health. Personally, he says, he finds strength in a morning prayer group, but still thinks he and others will have delayed onset trauma, like a Polaroid slowly coming into focus.
Right now we're in such, you know, head down, nose to the grindstone mode, that when it ends and you kind of take a breath, that's when the photo really develops.
Let us pray to the Lord for ourselves May we who mourn be united one day with our sister.
Despite the challenges, these workers are still finding ways to serve families. For example, they're streaming funerals online, like this one, for a Bergen County woman who died last month of breast cancer. They're helping families grieve together, even when apart. For Here and Now, I'm Nick Pugliese.
Today, the European Commission proposed an economic stimulus package worth more than $800 billion to help countries in the EU recover from the economic fallout brought by the coronavirus pandemic. Here's the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, speaking today.
We see the economic, fiscal, and social fallout across all member states. We either all go it alone, or we walk that road together. We pave a strong path for our people and for the next generation.
This package is built on a joint initiative unveiled by Germany and France last week. We'll hear from France and also Italy in a moment, but let's start with NPR's Rob Schmitz in Berlin. And Rob, we know Germany wasn't originally on board with this proposed stimulus package, but now that things are progressing, how significant could this be for Europe?
Well, for EU member states like Italy and Spain that were hit hard by this pandemic, this would be very significant. We're looking at, you know, around $800 billion worth of funds that would be borrowed by the EU and then doled out as grants to the hardest hit countries. But it's how the EU will pay this money back that's become sort of a point of debate in Europe. Over the next 2 decades, member states would pay this money back in proportion to their existing overall contributions to the EU budget. And this is why Germany, which contributes the most, was not thrilled with this funding mechanism. But in the end, Chancellor Angela Merkel came around. But it's possible this stimulus package may never happen because it requires backing from all 27 EU member states and their national parliaments. And countries like Austria, the Netherlands, Denmark, and Sweden have already said they won't vote for something like this. So there is still a lot of negotiation that will need to be done in order for everyone to be on board.
All right, let me switch gears here and ask you just how things are going in Germany. How much of Germany is reopening at this point? And are people practicing social distancing and wearing masks everywhere they go?
Yeah, you know, each state is in Germany is making its own decisions on how quickly or slowly it will open. The hardest hit areas of Germany, like Bavaria and in Western Germany, are moving the slowest. But up here in Berlin, restaurants are now open. Schools are slowly reopening. After school sports are there and all the shops are now open. But you see a lot of people still wearing masks indoors, but not so much outdoors.
When you say restaurants are open, are they open like they were before, or are they just at a smaller capacity,
no,
or what?
Yeah, they have a lot of rules that they have to abide by. Most of the restaurants, you know, throughout Germany are supposed to be taking names and numbers of people in case there is someone who's infected at the restaurant. They can trace it to everyone who was there, mm-hmm, and test everyone. In Berlin here, I have not seen that done in practice. So I think some of these rules are sort of being skirted here and there, depending on the locality. But, you know, a lot of the restaurants that I've seen here in Berlin are operating at around 20 to 40% capacity at the most.
And has there been an uptick in the number of COVID-19 cases and deaths as things have started to reopen?
No. You know, new cases of the coronavirus in nearly the entire country have been declining for the past couple of weeks. But there are still some pockets of the country in the south and in the west where you'll see outbreaks at a church or in a restaurant. But authorities seem to be doing a good job of isolating everyone involved before they spread the virus further.
And as you know, Rob, here in this country, there's a lot of difference in opinion about how governors, how the president has been dealing with this pandemic. How are people in Germany feeling about the government's response there?
Yeah, you know, by and large, Germans feel pretty good about how their government and particularly how Chancellor Angela Merkel has managed this pandemic. You know, the testing, the forensic way in which authorities went about tracing infections and the transparency that Merkel has shown throughout this pandemic has shown that Germany's system has worked pretty well.
That is NPR's Rob Schmitz in Berlin. Rob, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, joining us now from Paris is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley. And Eleanor, unlike Germany, France has really struggled with supply shortages, including face masks and test kits and even drugstore items like pain relievers. because France so heavily depends on global supply, despite years of warnings to not do that, is this being addressed by the government?
Yeah, well, belatedly, it is being addressed. And it's just been a glaring lack in the French healthcare system, which everyone, you know, has been vaunted for so long as being one of the world's best. And, you know, it's come to light because of this crisis that there, the country did have 5 billion or so masks in stock 10 years ago, but then began destroying them because they didn't know if they were still effective or not. Like you said, there are calls now to bring back production to France for drug producers to make even simple drugs like, you know, Tylenol and aspirin in France and not abroad. I spoke with an analyst, Christian Macarion, and he says Germany had the industrial capacity to just turn factories to make masks, and France had very little of that. Here he is.
Mm-hmm. We had no capacity for producing masks, industrial capacity. Only 4 plants in whole France were able to produce masks.
Yeah, so things like that have, I think the government is under huge criticism and people, you know, were waiting to get through the crisis, but there's going to be a lot of explaining to do.
Meanwhile, what does the reopening look like at this point in France? If you walk around the streets of Paris, are people at restaurants outside yet?
Restaurants are not open yet, Jeremy. There's still no date for that, although it could be June 2nd. Shops are open. People are out. People are ready to get back to regular life. Everyone is wearing face masks today. I've just come in from the street, and I would say 8 out of 10 people are wearing face masks. Paris was a hard-hit red zone. The parks are still closed. So you have people gathering in places they never did before. You know, little patches of grass that were considered too crummy before. People just took their dogs there to poop. Now people are having picnics there. So it's kind of, you walk along the Seine River and you have all these scenes. There was some guys having a barbecue in a parking lot last night by the river. It's because there's nowhere to go yet. The weather is beautiful and people are just thronging the streets, but they're wearing masks.
Paris in the springtime and
exactly.
nobody able to go to restaurants.
Yeah.
What about the cases and deaths? How are things going with the numbers?
You know what? It's going well. They're continuing to go down. And the government is going to, you know, take stock of everything this week. So people are getting more and more confident.
Are you expecting Americans will be able to visit as tourists this summer?
You know, I don't think so. France is the world's top tourist country. More people
right.
visit France than any other country. Yeah. So the tourist industry is going to be really hard hit. But I would say transatlantic visitors, I don't want to say it's not going to be allowed, but it's probably going to be discouraged.
That is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Eleanor, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, let's turn now to NPR's Silvia Poggioli, who is in Italy. Silvia, first, this stimulus plan, now it's yet to be finalized and approved, but if it is, how could it impact Italy?
Well, first of all, it will restore Italians' faith in the EU. Now, the plan would also defeat the so-called Frugal Four, Austria, Netherlands, Denmark, and Sweden, if it sticks to the idea of grants and not loans, because they accuse Southerners of bad management, big spending, and piling up debts. Now, they lost an important ally this week when German Bundestag President Wolfgang Schäuble, he was in the past Europe's most adamant fiscal hawk. Well, he said loans at this moment would only aggravate the situation in heavily indebted countries. And the Italian Minister for EU Affairs, Enzo Amendola, said this shows that the German leaders have understood that this is a crisis that affects the EU as a whole.
La Germania ha più interscambio con la Lombardia e con il Veneto che con il Canada e la Corea del Sud.
Amendola said Germany conducts more trade with the Lombardy and Veneto regions of northern Italy than with Canada or South Korea. European economies are closely intertwined and have to combat the recession together and rebuild together. Now, the crisis obviously will show whether Europe does hold together, but looking at how the pandemic has been handled elsewhere, especially in the United States, I think it has restored Europeans' faith in the idea of a safety net that provides for its citizens.
All right. Now, tell us how things are going in Italy. We've checked in with you several times throughout this crisis, but at this point, as the country has started to reopen, what does it look like?
Well, you know, just about everything has been allowed to reopen, but also with very strict safety protocols. There have to be a certain distance between customers and restaurants. There's a limited number of customers who can go to hairdressers. You need to make reservations, lots of things like that. But the problem is that many restaurants, for example, have chosen not to reopen. And that's because the extra cost of the safety protocols and the lack of customers due to the absence of tourism. It just doesn't make it worthwhile.
Well, and what about how Italians are acting with all this? Are they wearing masks? Are they still staying away from, you know, the kiss greeting on the cheek that we see all the time?
Oh, air kissing has completely disappeared. Social distancing and wearing masks are really the norm. The main exceptions have been young people, crowds of young people at cafes and pubs during happy hour. But nevertheless, the overwhelming majority of people here are following the rules, and it's a surprise even to themselves, because Italians are the first to admit they're not the most obedient of peoples.
Well, and as people follow the rules for the most part, has Italy been able to keep the numbers down in terms of cases and deaths in the reopening?
They've dropped down very significantly. It took a while. The so-called plateau was very slow in descending, but now the data is very positive, even in the hardest hit region in Lombardy. But all authorities say, you know, it's crucial to be very careful now. There's great fear of otherwise of another surge in the virus.
Sylvia, do you think you're going to see any American tourists in Italy this summer?
I'm not sure. I think they would be very, very welcome. But nobody's holding their breath whether they will start arriving.
That is NPR's Sylvia Poggioli joining us from Rome. Sylvia, thank you.
Thank you.
So great to be able to talk with NPR's terrific European correspondents all together, Rob Schmitz, Eleanor Beardsley, and Sylvia Poggioli.
Last night, hundreds of protesters, white and black, took to the streets in Minneapolis, enraged about the death of George Floyd, a black man who died after a police officer knelt on his neck during an arrest for suspicion of forging a check. It's difficult to listen to as Floyd, who's handcuffed and on his chest, pleads for relief.
I think we are the murderer. They will kill me. They will kill me, man.
They will kill me. Four Minneapolis officers involved in the arrest were fired. Floyd's family is calling for them to be charged with murder. And his cries, "I can't breathe," echo. In 2014, Eric Garner was videotaped gasping for air before he died as an officer held him in an illegal chokehold in New York. Eric's daughter, Emerald Garner, is here. And Emerald, you didn't watch your dad's video for years, and you haven't seen the Floyd video?
I haven't watched the video. I've seen still frames, and I just don't want to feel what I felt when I watched that video. It was just too much. And now I know that Mr. Floyd's family is devastated right now. And I just know that they're gonna be going through a hard time right now.
Yeah. But I'm wondering, you know, it's eerily so similar, you know, these petty crimes on street corners. Your dad was selling loose cigarettes. And then it leads to death. I can't imagine what's happening inside you just knowing that this happened.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. I call it blatant disrespect. I'm sure that those officers saw the video of what happened to my father. And to reiterate and to rephrase the exact same quote, which is, if you can talk, you can breathe. Obviously, 500 pounds of pressure on somebody is the problem. The medical examiner stated that my father's neck was crushed. I'm pretty sure that when the medical examiner comes out with his report for George Floyd, it will be the same exact cause of death. I am so happy that the mayor of that city fired those officers 24 hours later, but that was still even too long.
Well, I was going to ask if it helped that the mayor of Minneapolis passionately condemned the officer kneeling on his neck, that agents from the FBI and the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehensions have been called in to investigate. In the case of your father's killing, the officer, I think, was given a desk job and was only fired. It was fired much later.
5 years later.
5 years later.
Like, you know, as we saw with my father's case, there was no justice. For that family, they want to see the officers incarcerated, and I absolutely agree.
And what else would you want to say to them about getting through this? And again, these officers have been fired. They have not yet been tried. But putting that aside, just seeing, you know, knowing that this video is out there and that this anger is out there in the streets, what would you say to them to help them navigate this?
I mean, there's nothing that you can really say to anybody to help them navigate this. There's going to be days where they don't even want to get out the bed. I had a day like that today. Today, I didn't even want to get out the bed. I'm just like, I wish I could lay in my bed, but I can't because I have three young children who still need to be raised. I feel for that family because it's going to be hard.
That's Emerald Garner, daughter of Eric Garner, who died in 2014 after an officer put him in an illegal chokehold, responding to the death of George Floyd, who died after an officer knelt on his neck during an arrest. Emerald, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Hi. Last week, I went to a drive-through COVID-19 testing center in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is offering free tests to all residents. It was right there in a parking lot.
We're going the other way up and drive-through.
Okay, next stop. Thanks. Yeah. Medical personnel working out of a trailer, swathed in protective gear and helmets, directed me to the test. Oh, now somebody's coming up.
Robin?
Yes.
Hi.
There it was, the stick with the swab we've all heard about going up my nose.
Can be a little uncomfortable.
I heard. Should I just take the top of my mask?
Below your nose, yep. And you're going to rest your head back.
Okay.
Just try to relax, okay?
Okay.
1, 2, 3, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6,
oh boy.
5, 4, 3,
okay.
2, 1.
Okay.
Awesome. This is great.
It's a little sting.
Yeah. So you'll get a call in 5 days.
That's it?
That's it.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye. That's that. And I waited for the results. Now, there are a lot of questions about COVID-19 tests. How accurate are they? How often should you test? President Trump says the U.S. has tested more than any other country, but critics point out that we started later and are behind when it comes to per capita testing, meaning we have more people. And given that, our testing rate is pretty low. Dr. Anthony Fauci recently told NPR that our testing capacity is getting better, and he anticipates we might be where we need to be in the early or late fall. But where is that? Dr. Matthew Hines is an internist at Tucson Medical Center and was director of provider outreach for Health and Human Services under President Obama, where he assisted in the Ebola response. Dr. Hines, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm sure the suspense of my test results is killing absolutely no one, but I did finally get the call that I'd tested negative, which I was told in that call could be a false negative and could change. I could have been affected as soon as I left the test. And because of that, some people say, why bother testing? Dr. Sanjay Gupta told us the importance of testing is to find people who are positive and then trace their contacts. Do you agree?
Absolutely. And I would never discourage people from being tested. I think it's so important to gather as much reliable testing data as we possibly can to help track where the virus is, where there are hotspots, and address that by directing resources properly.
You've said you agree with Dr. Fauci that there's been progress.
Well, certainly overall the numbers of tests have gone up, that it's easier to order them as a physician. But for example, the rapid test is still very, very limited. Even in the hospital setting, it's very difficult to get the test that comes back in less than an hour. And in terms of distribution around the country, where we need to be doing more testing in hotspot areas like the Navajo Nation and in other areas where we can identify an increasing number of cases, we really need to be directing and making more testing supplies available in those areas, not having enough nasal swabs to obtain the sample or reagents to run the test once they get the sample.
By the way, you talk about the more rapid test, for instance, that President Trump and people in the White House are getting. Does that have the same concerns about, you know, maybe false negatives?
It does. They all have some inherent trouble in terms of potential for false negatives, which, you know, when you have tests that can in some cases have 15, 20, 30, maybe even higher false negatives, as a physician, I'm going to give you the same advice as I would give you if it had come back positive in many cases, right? But yes, the rapid test is particularly useful when it is positive. That helps us figure out where to safely admit patients to the hospital. It allows us to move forward with surgeries because it wouldn't be safe, of course, to be intubating people that are actively shedding virus for an elective procedure that would expose people unnecessarily. But again, those rapid tests are still very hard to come across, even in the hospital setting.
Well, and you know, you said you ordered a test for a patient and it didn't come back for 12 days. And you may have a patient in a hospital who's going in for something else, not knowing that they're maybe infecting people.
Exactly. These are patients that I'm seeing that have some kind of constellation of symptoms. Depending on what study you look at, we could be dealing with half of those infected having zero symptoms and still actively shedding a virus and just not knowing it.
You talked about an elderly gentleman who came in with his wife. You know, sounds like they were really in tough shape. She tested positive. He tested negative. You had to kind of do a little detective work and think, well, that makes no sense.
Exactly. And I didn't believe for a moment that he could not be positive for COVID-19. We immediately checked another nasopharyngeal swab. Luckily, we did have the rapid supply to do this. His rapid study came back within an hour as being positive. We were already assuming that.
Why does that happen? Is that because the way the test is administered, we know in the regular test, this stick, as I said, gets inserted into the back of your nose. But is it because it's being done wrong? Why are there so many false negatives?
I think it's multifactorial, and for sure, the difference in sampling technique is, I think, a major one. Most of the manufacturers recommend that nasopharyngeal swab be placed to the back of the nasal cavity and held there. The testing instructions I've seen say 20 or 30 seconds. They're not pushing it all the way back, and it's uncomfortable. No one likes to, you know, make someone squirm, but it's very important. You got to get that little swab into the right area and hold it there for long enough so that a good sample that potentially has those viral particles there can be obtained. Honestly, the tests are only as good as the samples that we feed into them. So that is a major problem. I think also if there's any type of delay potentially, I know this was something that Abbott was bringing up about their testing that had high false negative rate, their rapid test. And one of the issues that they identified was the length of time between obtaining the sample, putting it in that reagent solution, and then getting it to the actual device that does the testing. If there's a significant delay there, that can cause some false negatives as well.
Couple things that I want to ask about what you've said. First of all, you said people who test negative and positive, you kind of tell them to do the same thing. But if somebody is positive, don't they really have to quarantine, can't leave
Absolutely.
The house at all, live in a separate part of the house than other family members? Whereas somebody who's tested negative, they're just only going out if they have to. Isn't there a difference?
There is. That's absolutely true. In a hospital setting especially, you know, when we get those positive results, for example, preparing someone for a surgery, bringing them into the hospital, that process stops.
How often should someone get tested, given that you could get infected, you know, as you leave the testing site? And we also know there's a shortage of tests, so you don't want to use too many.
So for sure, if people are having symptoms or think they've been exposed, those are situations where we absolutely need to have testing. But more broadly, I think we must have more testing for sure in our hospitals, our nursing homes and rehab centers. And if they're going to be admitted to the hospital, they should just get a test. I mean, not every day, obviously, but for sure in a symptomatic situation, also in general, I just think we need to up the testing rates overall. We're going to get through this faster and with, you know, more people alive, frankly, and less illness, the more people get tested, the faster we can get up to that minimum level of testing, which depending on the experts you believe, close to about 1 million tests a day we should be seeing probably in the United States overall. We're about a third of the way there, about 400,000 tests that we're doing. When we get to those levels, we know we can reopen stuff more safely and kind of get things back to sort of the way they were with some modifications.
Why don't we have enough tests?
I truly don't know. It has been absolutely frustrating and confounding to me ever since I tried to order my very first test on February 5th, which was a 3.5 hour long process. The public health department of my county didn't have any, and the state of Arizona's public health department called us back. They didn't have any testing, and eventually we were able to get the person tested, have their sample couriered to the state, and overnight, I think they flew it to Atlanta to the CDC, which was literally the only place in the country for weeks that had any kind of test. A part of the testing did get messed up early on, but there was a test the WHO developed forever ago that we could have just used as soon as that one didn't work. And I don't understand the decision-making. It's just a very different department at HHS, which the CDC is housed in, than when I was serving. I don't know. So a combination of bad luck, and I don't think the scientists were allowed to be in charge of this. Either way, we're catching up finally, but it has been a frustration for me personally as a physician and all of my colleagues in the healthcare system that I work with that we're seeing these for a while there, tests coming back in 10, 12, 8 days later. That's just clinically useless. It's extremely frustrating.
Dr. Matthew Hines, Tucson internist, also former Health and Human Services Director of Outreach. His previous pandemic experience includes assisting with the domestic Ebola response in this country. Dr. Hines, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
In normal times, an estimated 30 to 40% of the U.S. food supply goes to waste, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. During the coronavirus pandemic, the figure is likely higher. Some farmers have resorted to dumping milk and plowing over crops because universities, schools, and restaurants that normally purchase large quantities of food are closed. Joining us now is Dana Gunders, who's the executive director of ReFed, a nonprofit focused on reducing food waste. Dana, welcome. And how does food waste look now compared to before the pandemic?
I think overall, we are seeing more food go to waste throughout the system. We're certainly seeing a lot of food be wasted in homes still, but I would say on a per person basis in our homes, we're doing better. Whereas when you look up kind of up the supply chain, we're doing worse.
Well, what's the solution to that part of it? Because one of the issues is that there are two supply chains. There's one for the big companies and organizations, and then there's one for the consumers. And it's not very easy for them to get the food that was supposed to go, let's say, to restaurants, to the grocery store.
That's right. So, you know, you might have a dairy facility that's used to packing milk in huge bags that go into milk dispensers and can't necessarily switch very easily to gallon jugs. So there are some kind of specialized equipment that have been hard to switch. But some of the solutions that we're seeing are that the government, for instance, is buying up a lot of the food that would have gone into the food service channel and asking processors and distributors to pack that up in a way that could go directly to food distributions at food pantries. And so they're actually absorbing some of the food that might otherwise go to waste. We're also seeing really creative solutions where restaurants, you might be buying big bags of flour and yeast at kind of that restaurant level quantity, but then bagging it up and selling it as an ingredient to their customers, which has been a great added revenue for them and a way to get some of that food that typically goes to the larger food service establishments into the hands of consumers.
What about for consumers if we're going more often to the grocery store and maybe buying more food than usual just to stock up and be ready for the week or whatever? Are there things that consumers ought to be doing that would lead to less food waste?
There are. And we are seeing consumers make fewer trips to the grocery stores and have each of those trips be larger. You know, what goes hand in hand in that are some very positive practices that can really help you waste less at home. So one is to just plan your meals better. Those who plan meals have dramatically less food go to waste. And that doesn't have to be, you know, pouring through cookbooks every night. It can just be really thinking through what you're going to eat and what you need to buy. When you have something like tortillas where you won't use the whole pack in one meal, trying to think a few meals ahead when you can use the rest of those ingredients. Another really important behavior at this point in time is learning how to store your food better. Because we are buying it, you know, more infrequently, trying to make sure that when you get home, you know, putting things in the right packages, freezing what you're not going to get to use really soon. Those types of behaviors can help buy you more time to have your food last longer.
Well, and what about those use by dates? I keep looking and going, well, maybe, you know, that's what they say, but maybe I could use it a week after that or 2 weeks after that, trying to push the boundaries on that. How seriously should we take those use by dates?
So those dates are meant to indicate freshness or kind of the best quality of food, but not when food goes bad. And they certainly are not meant to tell you that eating it will make you sick. A lot of people misunderstand those dates. But generally speaking, you can eat food. Certainly if you see the words best by or best of use by, those are foods you can eat well past the date as long as they look fine, taste fine, and smell fine.
Mm. Has this crisis, do you think, led to any rethinking of how to get food to people who need it faster? Any way to make the supply chain more flexible?
I do think we've seen the supply chain become more flexible through this. And on the business side, there are new relationships being built. On the transportation side, there's a lot of creative partnerships and companies that typically do things just for the for-profit channel, entering into the nonprofit delivery space, and a lot of just reworking and pivoting on the ground. We're also seeing online marketplaces pop up that allow any business with extra food to kind of post that food for someone else to then buy or ask for donation. And I think those are the types of changes that we will see live on well past this pandemic.
That is Dana Gunders, who is executive director of ReFed. That's a nonprofit focused on reducing food waste. Dana, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.